From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. At the center of Dave Janetta's film is a mysterious death. A math professor at the state college in the tiny town of Chadron, Nebraska, shows up. 3 months later, he disappears. Eventually, they find his body burned beyond recognition and tied to a tree. And there are questions. Was it a murder or a cover-up? Was it a suicide? We should say here at the outset, Janetta's film doesn't resolve the case. In fact, he doesn't think of it as a true crime story anyway. Janetta is more interested in the town and in one resident in particular, the writer Poe Ballantyne, who spent 6 years trying to get to the bottom of the mystery. Today in the program, we're profiling this film, which we're screening on Wednesday. It's called Love and Terror on the Howling Plains of Nowhere. After the news.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. Our online audio and podcasts are made possible by KUER and its listeners. If you like Radio West, help us make it happen. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. You can do that online at KUER.org. And thanks.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There are more than a few of us who are looking for something to replace the podcast Serial. Something to feed our affection for true crime. But we should say here at the outset that Dave Janetta's film isn't really a documentary that will do that, not in that way. It's true the film is built around a mysterious death. A quiet, nebbish math professor shows up at a state college in a small town and disappears. His body is found months later, tied to a tree, his feet bound. He's burned beyond recognition. But Janetta doesn't get to the bottom of the mystery. In fact, he said part of the challenge was to make a film that felt complete without having an ending like that. His film is as much a profile of that small town, Chadron, Nebraska, and it's as much about one resident in particular, the writer Poe Ballantyne, who wrote a book about the mysterious death. As Ballantyne himself has said, if you have a solution, it's a journalistic piece. If you have no solution, it's an aesthetic piece. And that's what the film is. And in many ways, that's what his book is. Today in the program, we're continuing our documentary series. We're profiling Janetta's film. It's called Love and Terror on the Howling Plains of Nowhere. We're going to be screening the film on Wednesday, and we'll give you the particulars about that as we go along. You can join the conversation if you like, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Dave Janetta directed, produced, and edited the film, and in 2009 he wrote and directed a feature film called Rachel and Diana. He's joining us from the studios of station WRTI in Philadelphia. Dave Janetta, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Doug, it's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Poe Ballantyne. Ed Hughes is known as Poe Ballantyne. He's an author and essayist. His work has appeared in numerous magazines and other places, the author of numerous books as well, including the memoir that Dave Janetta's film is based on. It's also called, of course, Love and Terror on the Howling Plains of Nowhere. And he's joining us from a studio at a radio station in Chadron, Nebraska, radio station KCSR. And Ed Hughes, Poe Ballantyne, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Well, nice to be here.
I mentioned we're screening the film on Wednesday. It's part of our Through the Lens series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. Wednesday at 7, we'll give you all of the details a little bit later. I should also mention there are going to be other screenings later in the week, and we'll give you more particulars about that as well. So, Dave Janetta, let me start with you. I guess the most basic question is, when did you first hear? We'll get to the story fairly quickly here, because I think that's the important, the mysterious death part. But when did you first hear the story?
It was about November 2011. I had just exhausted pretty much all of Poe's catalog, and I was looking for his next book. And I read an interview on a website called The Nervous Breakdown, where he gives a brief blurb of the film, and I was just immediately struck by it and thought it had to be a documentary, and so I wrote him a letter.
So what was it about the blurb that made you think this would be a great film? Was it the death mystery part, or did you know that since Poe Ballantyne was writing something, it would be something more than just that?
I mean, full disclosure, I had thought of trying to do something with Poe's work for a few months. As I was working my way through his stories, I thought it might be nice to do a narrative piece that was inspired by some of his work, or even just a profile of the film. But the way he laid out the mysterious death and tied it in with his life story, you know, I just felt that I could make it work as long as I had his story as the backbone.
I wonder, when you presented Poe, when he presented it to you, that he wanted to do some kind of a film about all of this, what was your initial reaction? What did you think about that at first?
Well, I wasn't very polite. Sorry to say, one of the few attractions of being a writer is that you get to do everything your own way, and I'm not a collaborator as a rule, so I wasn't interested. I didn't think it would work, but you know, I agreed to see him, and I saw that it was going to work, so it was quite a godsend, really.
Yeah.
Doug, I wrote him a letter. I typed it on my Olivetti. I thought he might appreciate that. But the first email that I got back from him started out, "All these buzzards and tarts want to chat me up when I'm trying to write, Dave, and so I apologize for lumping you with them." So that was my first, you know, response, but I kept pushing.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the story first, because I think it's important to sort of lay this out. Dave Janetta, take a shot at that, if you would. It's about Stephen Hadia.
Hadia,
forgive me.
Yep.
He shows up in this small town, and we'll get to the town as we go. Shows up into this small town in Nebraska. He's not there very long. Not really long enough for anyone really to get to know him all that well. He's shy. He's kind of interesting. Seems fairly brilliant, kind of a typical math nerd in some ways. And then he just disappears. So give us the sort of setup, the basic plot structure for that part of the story.
Sure. Well, I think he just did a pretty good job, actually. You know, I mean, he's immediately identifiable with Poe because, you know, as you know from watching the film, Poe spent much of his life in this sort of peripatetic, you know, cycle where he would just go to one place, stay for a year, and then leave. So, you know, Stephen, you know, that wasn't his story, but he showed up in Chadron. He had to start making a life pretty quickly. And being sort of shy and introverted, he didn't necessarily seek out the same channels that maybe you or I would, but he was making friends. He did have a small group of friends. He had joined the chorus. He would go to these film screenings that put on by a local professor. And, you know, he was making a life, and he disappeared after, you know, really just about 3 months. But as much as he was a math nerd, he wasn't just, he wasn't just sitting in his little basement apartment, twiddling his thumbs. I mean, he was making an effort.
He disappears for, this narrative plays out in the film, so I don't want to just, give it short shrift, but we should say, he disappears in December. I guess it's March, right, Dave, when they find his body?
It's March, correct.
March. And it's so strange because they find his body in this kind of a remote place, tied to a tree, I guess tied to a tree, if that's the way to put it. He was bound anyway. His feet were bound, and he was burned beyond recognition.
Yep. And, you know, you can set it up. I could cherry pick facts, and I could make you think it was a suicide, or I can make you think that he was murdered. I mean, the biggest thing about the way he was found is that his hands were not bound, which leaves open the possibility that he did do it himself. But his ankles were almost calf-tied, the way you'd rope a calf in a rodeo event. And he was tied to a tree, although the wrappings around his waist had sort of become loose. And I do have the crime scene photos. I didn't include them in the film.
Right.
Mostly out of respect for the family, and mostly because it would have been gratuitous. But yeah, an incredibly, you know, I've never heard of anything like that in my life.
The questions then that you kind of work through, some of them anyway, you know, the questions of whether he was depressed, whether he had, I mean, he had attempted suicide in the past. Which route did he take to get there? If he in fact got there himself, was he with somebody? Did he know some nefarious crime in some way that he was, you know, all this stuff you're working out. But one thing you've said, Dave Janetta, is that you didn't want to create a true, just a, you didn't want this just to be a true crime story. So let's start there. Mm-hmm. When, right at the beginning, you knew that this was your way in, I guess, like this was the way in for Poe's telling of the town and his own story. But it's about something else. It's about Poe himself. I mean, what did you know at the beginning, I guess, and as you started to shoot and as you started to think about it and as you started to talk with Poe about all of this, how is it evolving? Give me a sense of that.
Well, I mean, I'll say first off that, I do watch some true crime, but it's not something that I'm a huge fan of. I don't devour crime TV and you know, all those sorts of, CSI shows, but partly for me, it was trying to show everything that would have been left on the cutting room floor for those shows, which just include the most titillating sort of, overwrought, set pieces. And that's something that I didn't want to do because it's interesting to me what's happening on the periphery and what slips through the cracks. And you made the serial comparison early on, and I think Sarah Koenig did a really great job of that, including things, she included her dead ends, she included her, mm-hmm. her tangents that really ended up having nothing to do with the ultimate story. But I didn't really know a lot beyond that blurb when I first started. I knew that Poe had a version of the book, obviously. It had been sitting on the shelf for a while, but I consciously decided not to read it right away,
right.
Although he offered. I didn't want the book to inform the film from the outset. And so I really just wanted to listen to people talk and really see how this crime had manifested itself and metastasized or whatever you want to say, just to these normal everyday people that live in this town every day where this really strange thing happened.
Yeah. I don't want to spend too much time with the Sarah Koenig podcast, but since you referenced it and I was interested in that too, it's been interesting to see the reaction to that podcast from people who were expecting, I mean, they had such expectations, like she was going to solve this or there was going to be some neat and tidy sort of resolution. And I think a lot of the people who reacted to what happened at the end of Serial were disappointed in that. And I just wonder if that's an expectation that you thought about, that I'm not going to be able to satisfy everyone. It's not really what I want to do, but this is something that people are going to be looking for with this film, at least in part.
Right. Right, and especially in the way that the trailer is, and you can't help but sell it with using the most titillating sort of aspects of the story. I mean, nobody really wants to see a film about a traveling writer. I mean, it's not going to sell. So, I think in some ways I do set that expectation up perhaps a little bit too much, but I think, for me, I love Serial. I love the way that it ended, and I think that really in life, I mean, there really just aren't many concrete conclusions. I mean, there aren't many neat endings, I guess is what I want to say. And I think it would have been nice if I could have done that, but I think it's a lot more interesting to leave people guessing and leave people to come up with their own interpretations.
Paul, I wanted to ask you, in the film, we get to see excerpts from your book where you write about how you first got interested in this story, and you write that when you learned the circumstance of Stephen's death and that the police didn't really know what had happened and that there wasn't really an explanation for it, that you, here's your quote, thought innocently, I will solve this mystery and bring Stephen and his family some justice. Talk a little bit about that. I mean, did you really think you were going to resolve this thing? I mean, what were your initial impressions about what you wanted to write about?
Yeah, well, I went in with the full intent of solving it and sort of an arrogant belief that I would. It hadn't been properly investigated, and I was fully focused for as long as it took. And I still think we'll solve it. But I would have liked to have had, since the book is really 28% true crime and the rest, character and town portraiture and, parallels of my own struggles and so on and so forth with Stephen's life. I was hankering to close it with with a capture at the end, perhaps at least dramatically that has more possibilities, but it wasn't my choice to not solve the thing. That's what I wanted to do.
Yeah, it's interesting. I wanted to ask Dave Janetta, tell me about your first impression of Chadron, Nebraska, when you first arrived to scout it out. Because you've talked about how the texture of that town, and this is a really important part of the film, we should say, or just the images of the film, of the town itself, put aside the characters inside, but you've talked about how the texture of the town is a kind of a counterpoint to the narrative. So tell me a little bit about when you first arrived and how you started imagining how you were going to shoot this place.
Well, I rolled into town on about 1 a.m. on a, freezing cold December night, and it was just starting to snow and rain or whatever it was doing at the time. And I stay at the old Main Street Inn when I go, and Jeannie, the proprietor there, shows up and immediately gives me a beer, and we sit at the Long Branch Saloon, which is the bar, and it's just got all these crazy cool little knickknacks and things that she's picked up over decades of owning the place. And I woke up that first morning in the hotel, and I had planned to meet Poe probably 9 o'clock or something like that at his house, and there was just this weird ethereal orange light that was just seeping in through the Venetian blinds, and it almost felt like there had been some sort of nuclear holocaust or something outside. It was the weirdest thing, and I mean, it really set the tone. The town has this equally portentous and also kind of welcoming, comfortable atmosphere, and that's what it felt that way from the beginning, and it still feels that way when I go there, and that's what I tried to capture. Although people in town that have seen the film, some of them say that's exactly what it's like, and others say that's not where I live.
Yeah. I want to play a clip from the film. This is a scene where we hear from a number of people, mostly Chadron residents, actually. You'll hear from Dean Tucker. He's a philosophy and film professor at Chadron State College there. Also, Christopher Minshaw, who's a great character in the film. He's a kind of an angry Chadron resident. You'll hear from Joseph Applegarth. I want to talk about all these people if we can. Getting a sense. Amy Stone is another one you'll hear. Just talking about this place is described as having, Christopher anyway, describes it as having this kind of vortex of timelessness, the Chadron city. And this gives you a sense of that, of the town itself and the film. Here's a clip from Love and Terror on the Howling Plains of Nowhere.
There's something kind of, I'm not going to say mysterious or magical, but there's just something about this place that keeps people here.
Like Stonehenge or something, where they keep building these f***ed up religious sites on the same place, century after century. I don't know. There's some weird energy here, man, but I don't know. And I don't know if it's necessarily good.
So we're dealing with despotism, we're dealing with tyranny, control, all the things that we're seeing today throughout our society, and how we even have it in Chadron, Nebraska.
But here, in Chadron, there's not a whole lot of secrets.
Did you, how do you feel about the town now, Dave Janetta? I mean, all the people that you met, the interviews that you did, I think you could probably do 5 films with all the interesting characters that you find in this one kind of small town, trying to fit them all into this film, let alone the fact that it's about Poe, and let alone the fact that it's about this death mystery.
Yeah, well, I spent a lot of time there over 2 years, and I ended up developing some pretty good friendships with the people there, and I love it. I can't wait to go back. It's sort of this, it's really hard to explain, and this will be my Chadron Chamber of Commerce plug, but it's a great place to visit, and if you're just looking for an interesting weekend, go ahead and check it out. But yeah, the people are incredible, and it's just amazing to me that so many found their way into this one little community of 5,000 people.
Poe, you went to Chadron for the first time in 1994, as you explained it in the film. I want to play another clip here because I want to ask you about this. This begins with Jeannie, who hired you at the old Main Street Inn when you first arrived for four-something an hour, as you mentioned. But you had a very particular intent in mind when you first arrived in 1994. Here's Poe Ballantyne and Jeannie Gertzinger in the film Love and Terror on the Howling Plains of Nowhere.
I sat down with him in our corner booth in the saloon and went over his resume and asked him why he was in Chadron, Nebraska.
Oh, well, you know, to be frank, I was looking for a place to kill myself. But I didn't want to live anymore, so I got a motel and I was going to do myself in.
I'm reading the book, The Best American Short Stories, and he says, while cooking at the old Main Street Inn and deeply depressed and suicidal, and I went, oh my God.
Cooking was what I did more than any other job. You know, there were about 18 restaurants, I guess. It's the most interesting thing to talk about. How much can you say about a radio antenna factory or a chemical warehouse or a transmission factory or pest control? There's just not much you can say.
He said he would be here 6 months to a year. He told me he was here because it was a small town, he didn't have a car, and he needed a good library. He says, I'm a writer. I use this to support myself, and these jobs provide material for my writing.
I didn't expect to come out of this trek to Western Nebraska alive. I didn't want to live anymore. Things just weren't, you know, things weren't going right, and I didn't see any changes ahead. But I kind of got cheered up when I came into Chadron. I don't know, it was May, but it was cold, and it was snow on the ground, like I say, and people were nice, and the motel that I got had, you know, little doilies all over the place and a handmade counterpane.
So Poe, what was it about the place? I mean, where you figure you'd stay? Just it started to feel like, you say, like home, I guess.
Yeah, I didn't ever feel like home. I was, you know, I mean, I liked the town, but I was miserable here, and I left after 6 months or so, as I say in the film, and I went to Arkansas for a little while to get a friend of mine's story down on tape. I thought I'd make a novel out of it, but I was plunging pretty fast, so I ended up, you know, age 40, living with my parents. It took me a while to regroup, and so.
But I guess the thing that surprised me, so you went into this place, stuck around for not very long, about 6 months, didn't end up killing yourself as you intended. You went, and as the story plays out, you went to Mexico, you fell in love, you got married. I guess the thing that surprised me is that you came back to Chadron. Why did you go back?
I guess I worked out all right for them in the kitchen. You know, I have a lot of cooking experience, so I can do a lot of different things, you know, and make soups and roast meats and make sauces and whatnot, but they just wanted me back. They kept writing me, and I guess, you know, they liked me or whatever, and I didn't intend to go back, but when I was in Mexico and I met my future wife, and she had all these American dreams, and I decided to take her back, there were just very few options to make sure that she was safe and also to fit my requirements, which were, you know, pretty baseline economically, so... she was also going to, they also promised her a job, which was going to be hard to do since she only had a travel visa. So we ended up here. We came here, and I didn't even know if I was going to marry her at that time, but, you know, it worked out pretty well.
Yeah. Sounds like a very practical reason to go to any place, I guess. You weren't looking to document the character of a place. It was just, was circumstance?
Yeah, it was a pragmatic decision. That's my whole life has been based upon what I could do, not what I wanted to do, and the writing has always been a reflection of that. So unlike most people who write about traveling, and I don't consider myself a travelogue writer, you know, I write about the experiences that come my way not because I wanted to go to Montreal or, you know, or Versailles or whatever and stay in a hotel and, you know, and eat at the cafes and make my observations. It wasn't like that at all. Mm. So it was just, yeah, it was what was given to me.
Yeah. It's Poe Ballantyne. He's a writer, essayist, book Love and Terror on the Howling Plains of Nowhere, inspired the documentary film of the same name. Dave Janetta directed, produced, and edited the film. This Wednesday night at 7 o'clock, we're going to be screening it at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center in downtown Salt Lake City. Of course, it's part of our Through the Lens film series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. Poe Ballantyne and Dave Janetta, they're both going to be there on Wednesday for a Q&A after the film. We should also say it's going to be screening, if you don't have a chance to go on Wednesday, it's going to be screening in West Jordan on January 15th and in Price on January 17th. We'll give you all of the details on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We're going to take a quick break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're beginning the new year with a strange story told in a strange documentary film, strange in the good way. We're continuing our documentary series with Dave Janetta's film, Love and Terror on the Howling Plains of Nowhere. We're screening the film on Wednesday. Today, Dave Janetta is joining us along with the writer Poe Ballantyne to talk about Chadron, Nebraska, a small town with great characters, including Poe Ballantyne. He lives there. The film is about him, but it centers around a murder mystery, a college mathematician found tied to a tree, burned to death. The film is going to be, as I said, we're going to be screening it on Wednesday, and I'll give you more details about that. Dave Janetta, Ed Hughes, Poe Ballantyne, they're joining us today. Dave Janetta, you mentioned that you had read all of Poe's writing, and you've said before that he spoke your language. How do you describe your connection to his writing?
You know, it's interesting, and I think it's true of a lot of Poe's fans, is that, you know, I think we somehow identify with you know, his struggles and his courage, as he says in the film. That scene might have been cut, but there's just something, I think, in what he did with his life, with his sort of idealism, his artistic idealism, that I think most artists and most people, for that matter, wish that they could emulate, and very few of us do. And, you know, certainly Poe has, you know, mountains more experience than I do. And I think he's got, what do you have, 32 years on me, Poe, perhaps? Something like that. But, I've got time. But, you know, I mean, I think it's just that unrestrained artistic idealism where he just said, you know what? I'm 18 and I want to be a writer. College is what it is, and it's not for me, and I'm not going to write anything meaningful if I stay here, and I'm just going to pick up and go and do it. And, you know, it almost killed him, you know, obviously, as you see in the film. But I mean, that to me was what the connection was. And then, of course, there's just the humor, and he's a really funny writer. And it's a very accessible writing, and it's grounded in ideas, as he'll tell you. You know, it's not some tricky stylistic piece. It's not it's not an aesthetic. It's not just an exercise in aesthetics. I mean, he's just writes really, really good prose.
Yeah. I want to play another clip here. This is Poe talking about writing his life, and from early age, you know, convinced that, as you'll hear, thinks he was from somewhere else. He read a lot as a child. This idea that, in some way, he felt like he was maybe an alien in a certain place. Which I guess Dave Janetta helps us explain his wanderlust, right? Why he wanders as well as why he writes.
Absolutely, and you know, and I don't know if you feel this way, Doug, but I've certainly felt, you know, my whole life that, you know, that I never quite fit in where I am. And I think a lot of people feel that way. And I don't know if it's just part of the human condition or not, but, you know, I think that's another thing that spoke to me in Poe's work.
From an early age, I was convinced that I was from somewhere else. I don't have any sense of direction. I always had this whistling in my head. I just didn't, relate to people very well. And even when I did, I just didn't understand what they were doing and why they were so cruel to each other. I read so much when I was a child. I read things I didn't even want to read. I was reading. So I was convinced at some point that that I'd been put here as a sort of a conduit for another planet, you know. And all these things that I was learning about the Earth, where I didn't belong, someday they were going to come back and pick me up once my head was full enough of all these earthly things. And my parents were so nice. They were just wonderful to me. I thought, well, God, this is a good set of surrogate parents I've been assigned to from my home planet. Maybe it's one of the reasons I kept traveling, trying to find that place where I belonged, you know, if I'm trying to find my people, waiting for that ship to land.
Paul Ballantyne, you explained in the film one of the reasons you started writing. You say you wanted to feel like a human being and to, even though you didn't like the word, as you said in the film, to connect. You wanted, I guess, reach out to make people feel something. Do you think you understand that impulse about why you wanted to write, why you wanted to travel?
Yeah, really, it's simple for me. It's the same thing. You know, it happened first to me as a reader. There were just things that I read where I identified with. And, you know, a book in my hand was as good as a friend. A good book is just simply, in my opinion, a conversation. And so that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to write something that would make people feel like they, you know, like they belonged in my world. I'm sharing something with them. Often people send me they send me lots of stuff, books that they like and various gifts and whatnot. And it's, I understand it because I'm being intimate, I'm being vulnerable, and I hope in an eloquent way, and it's kind of like friendship. So maybe that's a better description of what I'm doing.
There's, Dave Jeanette, we should talk about the tension that exists in this story between some residents in the police department, former members of the police department, which really gives you a sense of what this town is like any town is like, that there's going to be petty squabbles and people aren't entirely all going to get along. And that really reveals itself here. But it's a pretty small town. How did you feel about, you know, airing some of the dirty laundry and then sort of walking away as they have to sort of deal with it as they see it portrayed in a film?
Yeah. I felt a little worse for Pogue because he has to live in the midst of the scrum. But, I guess from the outset, I just wanted to try and be fair to everybody and let them know that although they weren't going to get to have a choice about what the edit looked like, that I would be fair to them, and anything that they said was fair for me to use. So, I mean, they knew that up front, and we were just having conversations. And in some way, as I've reflected on it, I think in some way it was a way for somebody like Lauren Zimmerman, who maybe doesn't have much of a voice in the town. I think it was maybe a way for him to, as you say, air his grievances. And Carl Daly, the sheriff, he told me many times that anything he said I could put in and to please use it. So I wasn't trying to lead people into that. I really wasn't. I was just letting them talk. So I think just naturally when you are giving people an outlet or a way that they can have a voice, then they're gonna tell you what they think needs to be heard the loudest. Mm. So of course, when you see it edited together and you see the juxtapositions, and I guess there's a bit of humor, but you can see the tension. And I guess that's not always apparent when you're sitting, you know, in front of a camera that's how it's going to look.
We should point out that the humor part is real. I mean, you wouldn't think that this would be really funny, but there are a lot of places that are kind of laugh out loud funny. Not laughing at the characters, although they're really funny. But I'm wondering, are you getting that? Are people laughing in the screenings?
Yes. And two things about that. You know, we premiered in Toronto at Hot Docs, and the first screening, I mean, people, it seemed like there was a lot of uncomfortable laughter. I mean, chuckles. There was one guy who was great, and he just, you know, he tore it up, and that's kind of what you need in an audience. But you heard a lot of sort of soft chuckling, and I think people not understanding if they should be allowed to laugh. And So at subsequent screenings, I would almost give a disclaimer in the beginning, and that really seemed to help. I would just say, look, you know, you're not laughing at anybody. It's supposed to be, you know, a comedy, a dark comedy, I guess, you know, as well as everything else. So feel free to laugh. And it seemed to actually really help. So, you know, and the humor is an extremely important part. And I sort of figured that out early on in the edit. You know, it's the other side. It's the love to the terror. If you're going to present this horrific crime, you know, you need something to balance it. And yeah, that's humor.
Poe writes this. He says, no one was prepared for the news of the discovery of Steve Hadia's body and the way it would flood and capsize our little town. Poe, what do you mean by that? What surprised you about the way people would react to this story?
I think in 25 years there had been one murder, and that was a knifing in the park that was pretty straightforward. So, you know, people around here, we obviously have our domestic disputes and, you know, drunken brawls and whatnot, but murders is a pretty big deal. It's not something that any of us are accustomed to facing. Whenever I talk to Dave, you know, because he lives in Philadelphia, there's a siren going by every 5 minutes.
Right, right. But it's interesting, and this is actually brings us to one of the themes, Dave, in the film, that it's a critique of American culture in part, and what people do when something like this happens, which Poe describes as this explosion of misinformation and shock and whimsical consternation, sort of like a circus or a rodeo has come to town. Let me play another clip from the film. You'll hear Kathy Barr in here. She's a professor at the college as well. You'll also hear Christopher Minshaw again, the wonderful Joseph Applegarth. Here's another clip from Love and Terror on the Howling Plains of Nowhere.
I just remember over the course of the next few weeks, all sorts of hints and rumors and innuendos about him being bound with barbed wire and burned.
You know, of course, everybody had their opinion about it, and I probably got more opinions about things than most people, because I got an opinion about everything, you know.
My immediate reaction about how they found him and the circumstances was like, somebody has made a f***ing mistake. That cannot be right.
You know, it made me very suspicious, very, you know, incredulous.
And it was amazing. Within a week, you know, Bigfoot was out here eating babies. I mean, it was like unbelievable what came out of this initially.
Dave Janetta, what did you make of this part, this twist, this theme in the story? You know, how because a lot of it really gets at this question of what is true? How do we deal with the idea of the truth? Can we rely on our own memories, on our own ideas? I mean, that's a big part of the film.
It is a big part, and you know, I wasn't sure how big of a part it would be at the outset. I mean, it really became a much bigger part in the edit, and I think, you know, this is my first documentary, and I think it made me realize that, you know, every documentary, every film, every history book, all of that stuff, I mean, they're all, you know, a referendum on the truth in some way. I mean, you know, history, time, all that stuff is so fluid, and you can look at something like, you know, dinosaurs didn't exist until 1800 because nobody had found their bones, but until that time, there was no such thing, and history is constantly being rewritten. And, you know, if you take this small little example of this math professor who was bound and burned, and 5 years later, when I'm interviewing these people, there's still multiple versions of the truth. And, of course, the fact that the crime wasn't solved or investigated very well, you know, that didn't help out. But, you know, even within my film, people have pointed out, you know, a few mistakes. But, you know, right now, at this moment, my film, or certainly once it's released, will be, you know, the definitive account, you know, in addition to Poe's book. But, you know, what's true about it? I'm not really sure.
Poe, let me ask you, you say most people, with the absence of actual concrete information, kind of create their own version of the story, but you say it's a mechanism to understand what happened. What do you make of that?
Yeah, you're up against human nature, and, you know, reality is just too big to grasp, so we cut it into little pieces and try to organize those little pieces. And then once we maybe have one tiny square figured out to the best of our ability, we try to fit it in with the other squares, and then after a while it's just a mess. But we can't, I mean, it's just not within our capability of understanding. The truth and reality are just too big for us. And so it's a lot easier just to, you know, to reduce everything to, you know, digestible tablets.
It's Poe Ballantyne, writer, essayist. He wrote the book Love and Terror on the Howling Plains of Nowhere, of course, inspired the documentary film of that same name, which was directed, produced, and edited by Dave Janetta, who is with us. This Wednesday night at 7 o'clock, we're going to be screening the film at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center in downtown Salt Lake City. It's part of our Through the Lens documentary film series with the Utah Film Center. Poe is going to be with us along with Dave for the Q&A after the film, so hope you'll join us for that. Get your own reactions to this really strange story. There's also going to be two other screenings in Utah, West Jordan on January 15th and one in Price on January 17th. We have all the details on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take another quick break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are talking about the documentary film Love and Terror on the Howling Plains of Nowhere. It's Dave Janetta's film. He directed, produced, edited the film. We're screening it on Wednesday at 7 o'clock at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center in downtown Salt Lake City. It features, among other people, Poe Ballantyne, who's from Chadron, writer. Many of you may be familiar, of course, with his work. I wanted to ask you, Dave Janetta, how has his family reacted to the book? I know that a lot of them have been fairly outspoken about the fact that they didn't like the portrayal, either in the book or in the film.
Well, when I first arrived, Poe had reached out to them early on, and they were basically not going to help him. They didn't want him to do the book, and he hadn't talked to them for a little while. They caught wind of the film before I was able to actually speak with them, and they wrote an open letter to the newspaper just saying, don't help these guys out. They just want to exploit our brother's death and make money off of it, basically. And eventually I did talk with them, and I kept an open dialogue with them throughout, and we still share emails, and they've seen the film, they've seen a cut of the film, and, you know, it's been difficult for them, and it's been something that I've really had to struggle with throughout, you know, not only production but editing, because I do think that they have a right to excoriate me and to hate me and to think that I don't have the right to do this. But it brings up issues of, you know, who really owns this story? Who owns this story that affects this entire community? And if I'm not making some exploitative account and I'm really trying to just shine some light on the event and hopefully, you know, bring justice to their brother, I felt okay moving forward. And we have had family members reach out who have been very supportive. You know, other friends that have been supportive. They just haven't been as outspoken as his two sisters. And, you know, they said a similar thing about Poe's book after they'd read it. But one of his sisters emailed me and said, well, look, if this wasn't about my brother, you know, I would congratulate you on the film. So I think that's pretty judicious.
It's interesting, though, because I have to say, it gives a very flattering portrayal of Stephen, the film does. I mean, people speak in loving terms about him. So I'm not sure, the question, which is not a small question, that somehow you're exploiting this terrible tragedy. What is it that they were so troubled by?
Well, I think also it was just reopening wounds. I think they had found some sort of closure. They I think they're on record in one of the newspaper articles saying that they accepted that it's a suicide. Yeah. And I don't know if that's more for their own ability to gain closure rather than if they really believe that. I'm not sure. And they never really gave me much of a chance to tell them what I wanted to do. And they had already made their minds up about Poe. So. It was tough going, and I got a really long letter from his mom, and it just, you know, was just you know, it was tearing me apart, basically. And
I also heard that some of Stephen's former employer issued this edict, if I get this right, saying none of of their employees should talk to you. They should just don't talk. What was that about?
Yeah, well, we went to the school initially, and when I first arrived in town, we were just going around meeting people, setting up interviews in there. I guess their guy in charge of PR was really excited. You know, this is great. Let me talk to a few people, come back tomorrow, and this should be no problem at all. And instead of that, we get an email about a day later from their lawyers saying, this is a public school, so you can film on the grounds, but you can't film in any private part of the school. And also, here's the email that we're sending to all of the employees. And in the email, I mean, you know, it didn't go so far as to limit their free speech, but it did say, you know, it was strongly worded against them participating. And it essentially said, if you're going to do this, you have to make sure that you say that this doesn't represent the views of the school. And it was just strange to me because we missed a lot of, you know, really good interviews. But luckily, we had guys like Phil Carey, who you'll see in the film, who were concerned enough to speak out.
Poe, I wonder what one of the themes of the film, of Dave's film here, of course, is your connection to Stephen, the sort of parallel levels in your lives, or which is uncanny in some ways. And I'm wondering what you make of the fact that his sisters, in particular, have been disturbed by the book, disturbed by the film. Were you able to convey to them or other people that you feel a really personal connection to him?
Yeah, again, as Dave said, I said most of the case that they built was prejudicial, and they weren't even interested in sampling it. So they were, you know, I mean, I had no chance as far as persuading them, but it is true that one of the sisters read my book and gave me a 4-star review on Amazon. So I think they've come around, despite themselves, they've come around to appreciate, you know, and there were a lot of other people, including the county attorney, Vance Haug, who was not welcoming or cooperative in any way with either of our efforts, because it was his presumption also that we were, you know, a sensationalist team of jackals just interested in making, you know, boatloads of money and selling the whole thing to A&E or something like that.
So, Dave, give me a sense of how Shadron is reacting. We talked a little bit about this before. You know, you kind of stir things up, you air some of the grievances, and then you leave. You mentioned some recognized the town, some said, that's not my town. What, right. Do you get a general reaction yet? And have you been able to screen it in the city yet?
Yeah, I premiered it on Halloween night, actually.
Wow.
And it played for a week, and it was, you know, an appropriate atmosphere. Just the wind was howling and blowing letters off of the marquee, and of course they had some really bad technical issues. So there was only dialogue. There was no sound, or there was no music or sound effects. But, you know, people were there to see themselves, and I think to see the sort of, you know, the lens turned in the opposite direction, and people loved it. And it goes back to that, you know, sort of people will have their own subjective version of the truth or you know, an artistic experience. And I was really expecting to have at least one or two maybe threats or, you know, punches in the nose or whatever, but you know, across the board, everybody seemed to be pretty happy with it. And maybe they were just being, you know, Midwestern hospitality. But you know, I've spent enough time there, and I'm not. I don't try and hide. And when I am there, and people more or less know who I am, and you know, the reaction has been positive, which has been good, because hopefully it leads to people coming out and offering more information.
Well, Poe Ballantyne, I mean, that's one thing for Dave to say that. He lives in Philadelphia. You live in Shadron. What's the reaction been for you?
And of course, I've probably, you know, Dave did a masterful job treating everybody. And the people we were most worried about, I think, sent letters of congratulations. And that would be Sergeant Chuck and Jody or Joseph Applegarth. So he won everybody, and I didn't do that. You know, I was I was painting, and I was just saying it the way I thought it should be said. I was trying to be fair, but also I have to entertain the possibility of, there are three people, in the, as a matter of fact, there are three people in the documentary who I list as suspects. So
yeah.
They weren't, my welcome wasn't quite as warm, but I think overall it was pretty good. There were some threats and, you know, the lawsuit, the punch in the nose, stuff like that. And it's not, it, you know, if I could do it all over again, I would probably, you know, or if I had the money, I would probably move someplace else. But again, I'm stuck here by circumstances. So.
Wow. Wow. Dave Janetta, let me ask you this finally. You said you wouldn't mind if the film nudged Poe Ballantyne from the literary shadows, if that more people would come to know his work.
Yeah.
I guess that's what you're hoping in part.
Yeah, if that's, you know, if that is one thing that comes out of this, that's, I'm happy with that. He's just a fantastic writer, but it goes back to his artistic, you know, purity or idealism or whatever you want to call it. I mean, he's interested in writing and writing really, really powerful, you know, whether they're narratives or essays. And beyond that, he doesn't care. He doesn't use Facebook, and he doesn't, you know, he doesn't promote himself very well. And you know, I don't do that stuff very well either. But, you know, this film certainly is it's a chance for him, I guess, to as you say, be nudged from the shadows. So we're doing our best, I guess, is what you could say. So thanks for having us on here.
That's Dave Janetta, directed, produced, and edited the documentary film Love and Terror on the Howling Plains of Nowhere. Poe Ballantyne, author, essayist. Of course, his book is also called Love and Terror on the Howling Plains of Nowhere, inspired the film. Dave and Poe, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. See you Wednesday.
Yes. Wednesday night at 7, we're screening the film at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center in downtown Salt Lake City. Poe is going to be there. Dave will be there as well for a Q&A after the film. There are also screenings in West Jordan and in Price. We have details about that on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Technical direction from Mike Anderson. The program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.